The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation. Hey everyone.
Welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Kroom.
I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are going into forensic pathology.
And welcome back. We
apologize for the unannounced hiatus.
I don't know if I apologize really though. I think I kind of needed it.
Yeah,
I was
same.
Not gonna text you until you texted me when you wanted to actually get started again.
Same. Which is why we ended up not releasing an episode when we were supposed to.
Yeah. I feel like everybody needed a break after the past month worth of craziness that just happened. So yeah.
No, I agree.
But we are back and ready with a nice hard-hitting forensics episode.
Yep. So today we're going to be talking about electrocution.
So what is electrocution? Actually, before we start on that, we are drinking the second of the whiskeys in the whiskey tasting thing that my boyfriend got me for Christmas. This one is the Inchmurran, which is from the distillers at Loch Lomond Distillery.
Wow.
It's amazing. And this one also has amazing description. So also the end of it is, that's worth a whiskey whoa.
Okay. Yep. So once you finish reading, I'm going to go, whiskey whoa. like sushi go.
Get ready, guys.
Okay.
So the nose, sweet notes of freshly baked pain au raisin. I didn't read the whole word.
That was great. Pain au raisin.
Sweet figs and stewed apples. The palate is warming spices, which I definitely taste, woody hints with underlying sweetness, which I can see.
Yeah.
And the finish, this one
which
I don't get.
You can
get.
See, not taste.
Which I can. Wow. And smell. The finish, this is ridiculous. Apple crumble and custard on an autumnal day.
Whiskey whoa.
That just says autumnal.
Wow.
On autumn.
That is a 25-cent word right there.
But it is delicious, and it's very much so a scotch.
Yes. I do get the sweetness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the woody, like it's very peaty.
I don't know if I would immediately think apple crumble, but, you know.
Yeah, I don't get apple crumble though.
Maybe if I were eating an apple crumble while I was drinking this.
That's what we should have ordered. God. Apple crumble.
Dang, missed next opportunity time. For apple crumble.
Next time.
Love me a good apple crumble.
Oh, I need to make that apple crumble I made for your birthday again.
Oh, so good with ice cream. Just
so, the opposite of... No, not the opposite. I need to find a better second. Cut that out.
The opposite of electrocution is delicious whiskey. Put that on a shirt.
So instead of a zing to our tongue, now we're going to go with a zing to your whole body.
Yes, that was a good segue.
Thank you. So what is electrocution? Electrocution is death or severe injury by electric shock, electric current passing through the body. So this is derived from the words electro and execution. Because as we're going to go into in a bit, obviously, electric chair is a big thing people think of when they think of electrocution. But so electrocution.
Uh-huh.
But it's also used for accidental death. So essentially just like the word kind of caught favor.
Yeah.
And it worked very well. So this term was actually coined back in 1889. So not that long ago in the U.S. just prior to the first use of the electric chair. Originally, this was really just used for executions and not suicides or accidents, but because there were no other words, this one just kind of took up all the spots.
Yep.
The first injury from somebody from man-made electricity, of course, don't know when the first person got struck with lightning, but I'm sure it was a very long time ago.
We don't. That wasn't recorded on a cave somewhere?
Someday. Imagine the stick figure was just like a bolt of lightning going into them, and then it's like lines radiating like...
Yeah. But even if there were, I doubt they wrote the date.
Probably not. There weren't really dates back then.
Say what?
1500 BCE. No. Wait, what's BCE? Christ, who's that? Sorry, the first injury from man-made electricity was in 1749 in the Netherlands. Andreas Cuneus, who was an assistant to the guy that helped develop something called the Leyden jar, which was one of the first electric capacitors, received a shock while working with this first one of the first electric capacitors, which doesn't really surprise anybody.
Workplace injury.
Yay.
Somebody call OSHA.
That's what most of what we're going to talk about today is, to be fair. Mid-19th century, high voltage electric systems came into use, and then power arc lightning, which was used for theatrical stage lighting in lighthouses, started.
Hmm.
So essentially just like arcing, kind of like the big, what are they called? The metal balls that you arc lightning back and forth that you did in like high school.
Oh, yeah. I have no idea what they're called.
There's a word for them, but those things.
Big metal balls.
Big metal ball lightning. But it was called power arc lightning. And the first recorded accidental death was in 1879, when in Lyon, France, a stage carpenter touched a 250-volt wire, which, as we'll learn later on, it's not crazy high voltage, but it's still up there. And
still in the low voltage category.
Still in the low voltage category. So then from here, electricity spread to street lightning. Lightning.
No, street lightning. That's how we light all of our streets. We have controlled lightning storms, just like lighting every
California would always be on fire.
Oh, California is always on
That's
fire.
True. So when street lighting came into effect, many more deaths then happened from coming into contact with these higher voltage lines. And it kind of became known as like this strange phenomena that killed instantly without leaving a mark when people died from these type of electrocutions. And then in the early 1890s, this led to execution by electricity as an official method of capital punishment in New York State, which Nicole will go into more depth later, but essentially it was more humane than hanging. And
theoretically.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, definitely humane is in quotes on my paper. And the first official state execution was on January 2nd, 1889. And again, this is when the term electrocution became a thing. And the other bit of, I'm going to put this in the history category. Do you know who Topsy is?
No.
So Topsy was an elephant who was born in 1875 in Southeast Asia. But Topsy, girl elephant, was brought to the U.S. by the Four Paw Circus and advertised as the first elephant born in the U.S., even though she wasn't.
Great. So, false advertising.
Yep. So Four Paw Circus' biggest competitor was Barnum and Bailey, and there was a big competition for, like, who has the biggest and the best elephants, right? And Topsy was apparently a quote-unquote bad elephant after killing a spectator and then was sold to another group called the Coney Island Sea Lion Park. And here, Topsy was involved in several incidents, which were mainly attributed to her drunken handler, who at some point stabbed Topsy with a pitchfork, trying to get her to pull a ride.
What?
And police confronted him and apparently turned Topsy loose. Another time, like a couple months later, her handler, his name is William Alt, was drunk and tried to ride Topsy to the police station and have her, like, batter it down. And no surprise, Alt was fired. Because what is... What? Yeah. So this group, the Coney Island Sea Lion Park, got these new owners who were publicity hungry, named Frederick Thompson and Skip Dundee, or Elmer Skip Dundee. And their end-of-the-year spectacle was to kill Topsy.
What?
So,
what?
Yeah, it's super messed up. It's super messed up. On January 3rd, 1903, Topsy was fed carrots laced with potassium cyanide, electrocuted, and strangled.
Okay.
And apparently this electrocution is what ended up killing Topsy in the end. Of all of it, the electrocution is what did her in. So the reason I'm bringing this up, though, is This was all filmed by the Edison Manufacturing Movie Company, which I'm going to point out is ironic that it was an Edison company, and Edison was one of the guys that was competing in the War of the Currents.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they filmed this and released it in those coin-op kinetoscopes where you put in the 25-cent thing and they just, whirl around and you can watch it.
25 cents.
Or 25 cent now. Sorry, I'm thinking of the thing over at
The Penny Arcade.
The Penny Arcade. I was like, so you put in a look. Yeah, you put in a
that's
coin.
Like $500 in 1800 money.
But this film was called Electrocuting the Elephant.
Ugh.
And they say it's probably the first film that filmed the death of an animal ever. But Topsy was, in fact, unfortunately, died from electrocution, which we'll go into this in a bit, but a lot of the way you die from electrocution is high voltage through low resistance. But I feel like elephant skin has to be pretty high resistance.
For sure.
So, I mean, I don't want to know, but I'm curious how, like, high voltage they had to go. Yeah. It's just super sad. But yeah, the first ever recorded animal death was from electrocution because these were horrible humans that were trying to get more money for their business.
Humans are the worst.
Seriously. No debate about that at all.
Yeah. I feel like the tagline for humanity is just the worst.
Yep. Agreed.
So now I'm going to go into epidemiology. And we were both talking about this earlier, but there isn't a lot of epidemiology surrounding electrocution. And part of that has to do with the fact that it's so rare.
Yes.
And then most of the data that we do find is about occupational incidents.
And most of the data that people publish
is about occupational incidents. So the statistics I'm about to present are from the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health National Traumatic Occupational Fatality Surveillance System, yes. Which is quite the mouthful.
It's literally like a 52-page PDF. It's actually really extensive.
Yeah, it is, yeah. On average, from 1980 to 1989, and yes, I know this data is old, but like I said, there hasn't been a lot of stuff published recently. There were an average of 6,359 traumatic work-related deaths each year in the U.S., and of those, about 7% of the fatalities were due to electrocutions, which is an average of 411 per year.
Yes.
60% occurred to workers less than 35 years of age, 99% in men.
Yes, that was one thing that kept popping up. It's like, women don't get electrocuted.
Yeah. In terms of distribution, the highest percentage of electrocutions are in construction, so 40%, transportation, communication, and public utilities, which is 16%, manufacturing, 12%, and agriculture/forestry/fishing, 11%. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the death certificates that they were reviewing were pretty vague. So 83% of the deaths they were looking at couldn't be categorized. But of the ones that had more details, the majority were electrocutions that were caused by the person coming into contact with a boomed vehicle.
Yes, I love this term. It's my new favorite term.
That was in contact with an energized power source.
So that's just like something that has a long arm that connects to a little bucket.
Yeah,
that's what boom vehicle means. But I just love that term now. That's what I'm going to call them. Everything is going to be a boomed vehicle.
That's a boomed vehicle. I tried to look a boomed vehicle so I could give a more precise definition. And what I got was like, electric car prices are booming. And, you know, this is not what I wanted.
Not helpful.
Yeah, yeah. And then second most was ladder or scaffold in contact with an energized power source. Short-circuited, damaged, or improperly installed wire or equipment was third. Contact with a truck or other vehicle that was not boomed. Mm. And then finally, energized grain auger or grain elevator.
Yeah, that one I thought was awesome.
Yeah, which explains the agriculture being number 1, 2, 3, 4 in the categories of fields in which these workplace accidents happen.
The other thing that I saw in that study was you said that there were, you know, about 5,400 deaths. Those were only caused by 5,100 incidents. So there were a lot of incidents that had multiple victims, which I found was interesting. So, you know, most of them, 140 of them had two victims, which is like, okay. 11 of them had three victims. Mm. Two of them had four victims. So there were two separate incidents when four people died from the same thing. So imagine being that fifth worker and just being like, well,
that's not something
glad
I want to walk.
I wasn't
just
10 feet
close
closer.
The door and walk back out slowly.
Can you imagine being that one extra person? That's, I mean, multiple extra people, but that's still crazy. Imagine having that case as a forensic pathologist being like, now you have four people that, I mean, you probably still have to do a full autopsy
on each
them,
of them, yeah.
Even though you know how they died. But yeah, I don't know. It's crazy. There was another study by, I put this one in here only because it is the best last name either, Taylor et al.
Uh-huh.
You would. This was a 92 to 99 Bureau of Labor Statistics, very similar. Essentially, it's all the same stuff, 98.6% male. Highest rates were in whites and American Indians. By pure numbers, only over 90% were white. This one had interesting, it was the highest during the summer months in the South and in establishments with 10 or fewer workers, which I thought was interesting. And same distribution of where and age and all that other good stuff.
More workers, more precautions taken, maybe?
Maybe, or maybe more workers, more policies in place.
Yeah.
I don't know. And then, well, it's funny because the highest was 10 or less, but the next highest was 100 or more employees. And then the only other study that I had, which I mainly had because it wasn't just talking about workplace stuff.
Yeah.
There was a study by Massey et al. That looked at electrocution deaths in Maryland from 2005 to 2015. It was in the U.S. and it wasn't super long ago too, which I liked.
Yeah.
And they had, 55 electrocution deaths. They range from 4 to 83 years old, so a good range, with an average of 40 years old. More than 96% of them were accidents, and the rest were suicide.
Oh.
70% were high voltage current, which again, not too surprising, and then about 64% of those were work-related. And again, young men in contact with high voltage on job.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that, 35-ish% of electrocutions aren't in the workplace. So, which is still a good number, and I'm surprised that given that there are that many that aren't in the workplace.
They don't have more data about.
Exactly, yeah. And they haven't had much published data on that, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, I thought that was worth noting because it was just, it actually helped with some of the stuff that, we might actually see.
Yeah, I guess that could be your fellowship project. You're going to become an expert in electrocutions.
I mean, if we even see a couple in that amount of time, I will be...
shocked. I did it.
You win.
Yay.
It was cool. I don't know. Electricity is one of those things that, I think I've maybe seen one electrocution death, but it's not common.
Yeah, I've definitely not seen any. I just saw that Grey's Anatomy episode where a couple of them got electrocuted. That's the exact sound.
Okay, so like we've done for many of our true forensic pathology ones, we looked at DiMaio and DiMaio, which is a textbook on forensic pathology, and a lot of our information from this part on is from that book. We're going to sprinkle some other things in there, but they do a pretty good job covering the basics.
Yeah, not organized very well, but they do a good job.
So we're going to try to...
getting information in
there. Yeah, we're going to try to make that work. So... first thing that they say, which I thought was kind of funny, deaths are usually due to alternating current, since direct current is rare. And then when I was taking notes, I said, because Edison lost. Which is true.
Yeah.
So on top of that, it's rare, but humans are also 4 to 6 times more sensitive to alternating current than direct current.
I saw that stat. Did you ever see why that's the case?
I have absolutely no idea. Okay. I do not know electricity. I should ask an electric engineer.
You're not a physics expert.
I know. I went to MIT and I'm a slacker.
Oh my gosh.
And then they also say what cycles per second are the most lethal, which is 39 to 150. But how is anybody going to use that? I don't know. It seems weird. So speaking of me being a nerd and going to MIT, straightens my glasses.
I'm not even wearing.
I could put them on.
Oh, straighten your contacts. Just touch your eyeball.
I got my new Warby Parkers.
Oh, you did?
They look great.
Oh, cool.
I'll show you later.
Yay.
Straighten my contacts.
Yeah.
Twist them a little bit so the astigmatism straightens itself out.
Mm-hmm.
So amperage, which is current flow, is voltage over resistance. So amperage we'll go into is really what kills you. So you can die from electricity due to either high voltage or low resistance that we'll get into more in detail later. So starting in voltage, normal residential voltage is about 150. So coming out of the outlet is about 150 volts. High voltage power lines, which are the high tension lines that you see on the side of the street, are an order of magnitude higher. It's 7,620 volts. So much higher.
So exact.
That's what the book says. And then transcontinental high tension lines, which I didn't even think about, are 100,000 volts or greater. So just
nope.
Don't go anywhere near that. You will die instantaneously.
I mean, go near it if it's your job, I guess, but yeah, be careful.
That's fair. All the protection. Yeah. And then the other half of that is, so amperage is voltage over resistance, so high voltage or low resistance. So in humans, the main resistance that you have is skin. You have greater resistance the more dry your skin is and the more thick it is. So resistance is measured in ohms. Normal skin is, it seemed like it was around 1,000 to 10,000. But like really thin skin could be as low as 100 ohms.
How do you know if you have thin skin?
I think that's like, you know, lips or mucous membranes and that kind of thing.
Okay.
Or like you're injured and you have the first layer of skin. I think that's what that means.
That makes a lot of sense. I was just like, do some people just genetically have thinner skin? How can I tell? My veins are kind of blue.
Yeah, right. And then this, I think, is really interesting. So from, I'm going to use the word moist, I'm sorry. From moist skin to dry skin,
I don't care.
Ranges everywhere from 1,000 to 100,000. So it's two orders of magnitude that are different just if your skin is wet or dry.
Mm-hmm.
And then calloused skin, so that's like the bottom of your feet or your palms, especially if you like lift, that can be up to like 1,000,000 ohms. So really your skin does change this a lot. And then, like I said, since voltage is usually pretty constant out of an outlet, resistance is really the thing that matters the most. So, you know, anybody is going to be exposed to the same wire that's sticking out of the wall, but that's still going to be about 150 volts.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends on what you touch it with. And then, of course, the current runs from the point of contact down to the ground. So we'll talk about that in some of the autopsy findings that we see. But current wants to find its way kind of back to the grounding point, which is down, usually through your feet.
Yep.
And then...
unless you're doing a handstand.
Ooh, handstand to your foot touches the wire. That would be fun.
Yeah.
Just find the person down on the ground. You don't know which one is the entrance or the exit, or do you? As I said, the amperage, the current, is what kills you. And amperage is measured in amperes or amps. So we're going to be speaking in milliamps. That's how little it takes. So a milliamp is a skin tingle, right? That little tiny bit you get. 5 milliamps will cause muscle tremors. 15 milliamps, so this is only 15 times, is a muscle contracture. So that's what will make a muscle tighten. About 16 milliamps is the maximum current that the average man can grasp and then actively make himself let go, which is a really important fact for like if you're stuck on a line or something, you have to be able to let go of it and to stop that from going through your body. About 20 milliamps is the paralysis of your respiratory muscles, which one of the more important. And then from 75 to 100 milliamps is where you can get into ventricular fibrillation. And that's the electric current through your heart that just kind of makes the different parts of your heart just spaz out, for lack of a better way to put it.
And I hope one day you describe to a jury VFib as your heart spazzing out.
I realistically probably will do that at some point. So we've been talking in milliamps. So now I'm going to go up to amps. So 2 amps is when cardiac standstill happens, so ventricular arrest, your heart stops beating. Now, if that current happens briefly and it stops, your heart can start up again, but it needs to be very quick. And 15 to 20 amps are when common fuse breakers open the circuit. So you need actually quite a lot of current in order for the circuit breaker to trip. And as I just said, all of this is under that point. So how do people die from electricity? So low voltage, which is what people are exposed to in their homes usually, you need to touch the circuit directly. And usually this is due to that heart condition, that ventricular fibrillation. So your heart can no longer beat normally. Now, if you can do CPR, or you can use a defib on them, they can get the rhythm back. But, you know, you can go into VFib and you won't necessarily jump out of it immediately. Now, high voltage lines are a different story. You don't actually need to touch these, which this was probably the point that freaked me out the most. This electric arc can jump. So If it's about 1,000 volts, it can jump a few millimeters, but up to 100,000 volts, which were those transcontinental lines we talked about, mm-hmm. can jump up to 35 centimeters. That's a good chunk of distance. You don't need to be that close to them, so really stay away. And the other thing that I found crazy is the temperature can, in these high voltage jumps, in high voltage lines, can reach 4,000 degrees Celsius. The sun is 5,500 degrees Celsius.
Oh, good. This is great.
It's really, really hot. And then, as I kind of alluded to before, the length of exposure that's needed to kill you depends based on the mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. So if we talked about how 20 milliamps is when your respiratory muscles are paralyzed, right? So if you hold on to that electricity for long enough that your body is deprived of oxygen, you need a little bit longer time. But if you can just go into VFib, it really only needs to be milliseconds before it'll kill you. So we can kind of step through each of them, but you know, for most of the low voltage lines, it needs to be for some appreciable amount of time, unless it can drop you into VFib. Mm. And then it can just be very quick. High voltage is a very different story, because usually these deaths are due to electrothermal injury. So that's the heat that I described up to, you know, 4,000 degrees Celsius. That injury can be enough to essentially fry the respiratory center in your brain. And this high voltage injury can actually be seen in judicial executions as well, which is interesting. And we'll go through some of the findings from these, but essentially you can just get crazy burns and then like your brain can get really hot. The official way to say
it. In a literal way. So in terms of the autopsy, electrocution is one of those diagnoses of exclusion that we talk about in forensics. And one of the other ones we've talked about before was drowning. So in death by electrocution, some of the things that you can look for are electrical burns. Mm-hmm. And all high voltage and about 50% of low voltage electrocutions may have electrical burns at the point of entry, which is usually the hands or tips of the fingers, and or the point of exit, which is usually the soles of the feet. But
unless you're doing a handstand.
Unless you're doing a handstand. Unless you're doing a handstand or you are touching the electrical wire with your mouth.
Nom, 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 nom.
And then if the current enters over a broad surface area that offers minimal resistance, there can be no burns. So this is something like a bathtub where it's kind of the current is more diffuse.
So it was interesting when I read this, if I'm sure you've seen plenty of cases at the ME now when somebody is found in a tub.
Yeah. Right?
And always at morning meeting, the MEs always ask, was there water in the tub?
Yeah.
And for the longest time, I was like, kind of curious why, but I think this makes a lot of sense, right? Because if you find somebody submerged in a tub, like, and it's full of water, one of the key things you're going to have to exclude is electrocution. But also, like, even if their clothes are wet, right? Because, like, if they're, you know, or I guess if they don't have clothes on, it doesn't matter as much. But, you know, like, you can, if you electrocute them and then drain the tub, right? Like, you can make them go away. But it's, I don't know, there's one of those things I never thought about. It's like, oh, wait, yeah, the tub being full is really important. Because in this case, if I guess more if the tub is full, then you really have to rule out electrocution.
Yeah, I guess I always thought that question was more for drowning, but
I think that too, but like you said, yeah, those are the two that you have to rule out. And I'm like, oh, because you have to think of it, right? Like if somebody murders somebody in a tub and then takes stuff away, like you would have no reason to
suspect that unless you had a high
index of suspicion going into it. Yeah.
So. Oh, that's right. That's true. Yeah.
Sorry. Back on track.
No, that's a good aside. And then electrical burns are more likely if there's prolonged contact, and that's due to the current being a source of heat, as Jordan mentioned before.
Burn.
Burn, baby, burn.
Disco would burn, no.
And then skin metallization analysis can help to distinguish between whether a burn is due to electric injury or thermal injury. And this is because when a current passes from some sort of metal to the skin, metallic ions can become embedded in the skin and other surrounding tissue. And burns are kind of categorized in different ways. A lot of people are familiar with like first degree versus second degree versus third degree. I think nowadays medicine is moving away from that terminology and more towards superficial.
Yep.
So this is the
first degree burn, where the outer layer of the skin is affected by the burn and there's pain, redness, and swelling. Second degree burn is now called a partial thickness burn. And that's when the burn affects both the outer layer of the skin and the underlying layer of the skin. And this can lead to pain, redness, swelling, and blistering. And then third degree burns or full thickness burns are the ones that are more often seen in high voltage electrocution. And this is burns affect the deep layers of the skin, and it can cause white or blackening of the skin at the surface.
One other thing that I found interesting with burns is a lot of the time you can't differentiate anti from postmortem burns.
Oh, right, yeah.
So if you've been electrocuted, you don't necessarily know if that happened before death or if for some weird reason after death you got electrocuted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, you know, we tend to spend a lot of time on. It's like, did this happen before or after death? But unfortunately, these are one of the things that even with electricity, you can't tell.
Yes. And then another thing that you can see on autopsy is fractures. So Jordan mentioned earlier that at a certain current, you get involuntary contraction of your muscles. And so this contraction can be strong enough to cause fractures. It can also...
Of bones, right?
Of bones.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And the muscle contraction can also lead to accelerated onset of rigor mortis, which we discussed in an earlier episode, but that's that stiffening that occurs after death. And it's due to depletion of the thing that helps your muscles to relax. And so the contraction will use up all of that substance.
Called ATP.
Called ATP really quickly. So rigor will develop a lot more quickly than normal.
Which also means it'll go away more quickly than normal.
Yes.
So like depending on where you are in the timeline, you just kind of have to shift everything.
Yes. And another interesting thing that was in the book was that the rigor can be along the path of the current. So it could be more along one side of the body than the other side of the body, which would be very interesting to see at autopsy.
Why is one side so floppy and the other one so stiff?
Yeah. And because it's a diagnosis of exclusion, I came across this one paper that was talking about some like more new agey ways of trying to determine whether or not an electrocution caused the death. So one of the things I talked about was using a special form of microscopy called scanning electron microscopy,
yes.
Which can detect different changes in the skin if there is a burn, but also you can use it to look at your pulmonary vessels to see if there's damage to the vessels. That could be a sign of electric current flow. And then you can also do some post-mortem testing on the blood to look at some cardiac labs. So when your heart gets injured, it releases some substances that we can test for in the blood.
Called troponin.
Called troponin.
It's this protein, and it starts circulating through the blood in different forms.
Yes, but if you have an MI, you can also get also get elevations in this thing because it's just a sign of damage to your heart muscle, not
exactly
a specific sign of electrocution. But it can help if you aren't seeing any signs of like cardiovascular disease, but you're seeing these high levels of troponins. You could be like, oh, then what was causing the heart injury? You could be like, maybe it was electrocution. You can also see changes to the actual heart tissue under the microscope, but you know, those can also be seen in some forms of natural disease, so not specific to electrocution.
I thought some of the high voltage injuries were also really interesting because when it's low voltage, it's kind of more subtle things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then high voltage just kind of gets crazy. As we said, it can get really hot. So like it can get so hot so fast. Like, you know how when you have butter in the microwave and then it reaches that boiling point and it like can... You break the surface and it explodes. Has that ever happened to you?
No.
Yeah, if you, like, heat up... It happened to me with frozen butter the other, like, a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was microwaving it, and I took it out of the microwave. And then once it got out of the microwave, like, the temperature differential was enough, and it literally just exploded everywhere.
Whoa.
So, like, if the change in temperature happens quickly, it can explode. So, essentially, you can get massive destruction of tissue with loss of extremity and rupture of organs when you have a high-voltage injury.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those things that's like, did something explode? And the answer is yes. Yes, it did.
Yeah.
And that's from very high-voltage things, but that can happen. And then also with high-voltage, you kind of get those arcs that we were talking about earlier. And instead of just having burns on the entry and exit, you might get these other small burns from the arcing current that is causing damage throughout the body. So it's high voltage is just another beast entirely.
Yes.
And I'm guessing a lot of this is more construction site than at home and accidental. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. Somebody's illegally wiring their home and they accidentally shock themselves with some high voltage.
I'm sure that happens more. Get an electrician. It's worth paying for somebody who's not going to kill themselves.
Yeah.
Accidentally.
Yeah. Hopefully. And then in terms of manner of death, we kind of touched on this with a lot of the epidemiology, but most deaths due to electrocution are accidental in manner.
Like more than 95%.
Yeah. And as a reminder to everybody who is maybe listening to this as their first episode, manner of death is we place deaths into any these five different categories. And so we can choose between homicide, suicide, natural, accidental, and undetermined. So most of these deaths are accidental in manner. And suicide and homicide are rare, but do occur. Mm-hmm. And most homicides are from somebody, the murderer, dropping a plugged-in electrical device into a bathtub. Yep. And as I mentioned before, usually there are no electrical burns because this is widespread contact. And if the device is removed, the cause of death as electrocution could be missed.
Yes.
And bathtub electrocutions, though, have become rarer.
This is cool.
Yeah, because there are these things called ground fault current interrupters, and these monitor the current flow, and they are required in certain rooms in the house, including the bathroom. And if these GFCIs detect a current greater than 5 milliamps, then the circuit breaks and shuts off, so you can't actually electrocute yourself.
I think, like, you could if you have that, if you happen to hit V-fib.
Yeah.
But you can't have, like, those prolonged, like, respiratory muscles are tightened for too long kind of thing. So it's harder now. Anyway.
Challenge accepted.
Murder. Do I have to watch out in Seattle? Lock the bathroom door?
Yes, please.
Although, if we have our own bathrooms. And so the last big category, which I'm sure everybody's been waiting for, is lightning. Good old Ben Franklin. Kite. So lightning is when the charged undersurface of a cloud discharges to the ground. And because the charged undersurface is usually negative, the vast majority, 95% of lightning strikes are negative. But there is a very small portion, which I'd never realized until researching this, that are positive. So about 5% of lightning strikes are positive charge. So you can be killed or injured from a lightning strike from either a direct strike, which is, you know, lightning out of sky into your body, a side flash, which I didn't realize was a thing, whereas like it hits something like a tree and then jumps to the individual that's close by.
Yep, didn't know that was a thing either.
Yeah. Or this one I didn't know about, conduction through another object. So it hits a crane or a boomed vehicle, and then it goes through you and then into the ground.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the big three categories. So either direct or a side strike, the current can spread over the entire body, or enter the body, or do both. So if it kind of spreads over the whole body, you might not really see anything. But if it enters it, you might have that point of entry and point of exit burn. It kind of depends on what you're seeing or what the mechanism of lightning entry was. So some common findings, again, these definitely fall under the high voltage injury. And like I said, things go boom. So you can find torn clothing, mm-hmm. burst shoes. And then the burns that you see can either be at the entry or exit. Or, I found this interesting, so metal obviously conducts electricity better. So if you're wearing anything metal, so rings, zippers, you know, boot eyes, like the eyes in the hole of boots, like anything with metal on it can conduct it better, and you're more likely to find a burn there. But if they're not wearing any metal, you might not see any burns at all. The other interesting thing is, again, high temperature, kind of like your brain gets cooked, you can find ruptured tympanic membranes, which are your eardrum. It's a medical term for eardrum. So that's another thing you can see. Sometimes you see some bleeding associated with that. When you're in a vehicle, you're actually pretty safe because it kind of just conducts around the vehicle because it's a much more direct path than going from the vehicle into you and then blah. And
lightning is lazy.
Lightning is lazy. And then rarely, you know, you're using a telephone or something and the line gets hit and then it can go through you. There's something weird can always happen. There's always some weird path that electricity might take. But long story short, you're pretty safe in a vehicle, but just don't go standing out in the middle of a field or don't go touching metal objects in a lightning storm. This seems like a bad idea.
Okay, making a mental note.
The mechanism of death, again, this is high voltage. So we talked about this before. Usually it's going to be pulmonary or respiratory arrest or the electrothermal injuries. So with a direct hit, you're going to have burns and injury to the respiratory center in your brain. And we were mentioning the amps of some of this stuff earlier. So, you know, 2 amps is going to cause ventricular arrest. 2 amps. Lightning is in the kiloamp range. So 2,000 amps. So it's such a high current that it's going to kill you instantly. If you have one of those side strikes or, you know, it was close proximity, you could survive this. But if you have a direct hit, you're pretty much toast. Pun intended. And the other thing that I'll note is there's that ferning skin pattern that people tend to think of when they think of lightning strikes. This doesn't always really happen. It can pop up about an hour after a strike and will fade at about 24 hours, but we're not really sure what the mechanism of this is. It could be when, you know, a negative bolt hits and then a secondary positive flashover from a nearby object happens. Or they're thinking that it also might be from that rare positive lightning strike. Like I said, 5% of them were that. Hmm. But this is actually a pretty rare thing to see, and neither of these particularly explain the rarity of this event well. So some things are up there, but, you know, you see that ferning pattern on the skin, and that's associated with lightning strikes, although we don't really know how or why.
Yeah. And we'll post some photos to social medias.
Yes.
And for any budding forensic pathologists out there, a picture of this, what are called Lichtenberg figure, is high boards fodder.
Yes, for sure.
That and the Wisniewski spots that you can see in hypothermia. Yes, if I'm saying that right. Wisniewski?
Something like that.
Yeah.
So, Nicole, tell me a story about how people die from electricity.
Okay. So, when I was researching a story to talk about, I hadn't even been thinking about the electric chair, but the stories kept popping up about, like, people on death row were petitioning to be executed by electric chair. And so,
which seems crazy.
Yeah, it does. But, I mean,
I don't really want to die anyway, but...
True, true. It just seems like a lot of the ways that we have chosen to do the death penalty are problematic.
Suboptimal?
Yes, suboptimal is a good PC phrase. So I came across the strange and gruesome history of the electric chair and thought I would talk a bit about that. So the inspiration for the electric chair was sparked by the death of a Buffalo dock worker named George L. Smith in 1881. So a local electrical power plant near where Mr. Smith lived was encouraging citizens to tour the facilities to help dispel the fears and superstitions people had about the strange new magic of electricity. And visitors realized that they could experience an enjoyable tingling sensation, so that 1 milliamp range, if they touched the railings surrounding one of the electrical generators. So one night, after drinking for hours with his friends...
Sounds like fun.
Hashtag hold my beer, bro. Smith broke into the plant and over-enthusiastically grabbed hold of the generator itself with both arms. And he died instantly.
Yep.
And was discovered by staff. And his corpse was still clinging rigidly to the generator because of that muscle contraction can experience. So to onlookers, it looked like Smith had died instantly and painlessly without a mark on him. Which is where Alfred P. Southwick, engineer-turned-dentist, who you mentioned earlier, comes in.
I love that it was a dentist.
I know.
I didn't realize that until this. I was like, that's dumb, but
okay. Well, he was an engineer first, I guess he was in that mind space. And he had experimented with using low-voltage currents as a numbing agent for dental surgery before.
Creeper.
And then Smith's death convinced him that the power of electricity could be harnessed for executions.
You should be one of those, like, carnival speakers.
That's great.
carnival barker.
Yeah.
Oh, that I would the have power a great of outfit. Electricity.
Oh, you would. I mean, you have a great outfit all the time anyway.
Wow, thanks.
I meant it.
So with the help of Dr. George Fell, Southwick began experimenting by electrocuting hundreds of stray dogs in the Buffalo area.
I hate people.
Yeah.
Cole, come here. I need to cuddle you.
This article went into some gruesome details about the experiments that I'm not going to talk about, but suffice it to say that people are the worst.
Yep.
So during this experimentation process that Southwick and Dr. Fell were doing, a commission was set up by the New York State governor to look into alternative methods of execution so that they could go beyond the Dark Ages technique of hanging. So okay. The idea of the electric chair eventually won out against all the competing methods, and that was partly because of the endorsement by one of America's most renowned people, Thomas Edison.
Yep.
Yep. So
Edison was direct current.
He was direct current. So Edison was direct current, and he had an arch rival named George Westinghouse, who was alternating current. So Edison wanted to try to dirty the image of the alternating current by having it linked to death.
Yes.
So he wholeheartedly backed AC power for the electric chair.
Even though AC power is actually better for an electric chair because people die easier with AC than DC.
Yes. So his backing was actually true.
Yes.
But he was doing it
for the wrong reasons.
And then one of Edison's colleagues even suggested the word Westinghoused should be used to describe electrocution.
Like make it a verb?
Yeah.
Verb my noun.
Yep. So when the first electric chair was built, Edison's people even saw to it that three Westinghouse generators that were scheduled for decommission were brought in to power the chair.
Wow.
Yeah. And Westinghouse tried to fight back by hiring a lawyer to halt the first execution by electric chair, but it was to no avail. And on August 6th, 1890, William Kemmler, an alcoholic who'd killed his girlfriend in a drunken rage, became the first person to be executed by electric chair.
Okay.
And at first, the electrocution seemed to be going according to plan, but then horrified onlookers noticed that Kemmler was still breathing after being given what should have been a fatal dose of electricity.
Whoops.
So they flipped the switch and more volts ran through Kemmler. And as they did, his blood vessels began to explode under his skin and his hair began to burn. So a journalist...
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh. That's horrible. Yeah. It's such a failure.
So a journalist who was present wrote, "Blood began to appear on the face of the wretch in the chair. It stood on the face like sweat. An awful odor began to permeate the death chamber."
I mean, not that I endorse any experiments on animals, but like, how do you not figure out what you need first?
Hundreds of stray... Yeah, I don't know.
Like, I mean, I get dogs are different than humans, but still, like, I don't know.
Because they're better than humans?
They are better than humans. 1,000% better than humans.
Yeah. So despite this distressing start, the electric chair was soon adopted across different states as the favored method of execution.
Yep.
And amongst the many convicts that were executed by electric chair, the chair also took the life of the youngest person ever to be executed in the U.S., a 14-year-old black boy.
Of course. I mean, of course.
Named George Stinney, who was accused of the murder of two white children in 1944.
Because a 14-year-old has any kind of real sound mind to make any decisions.
Yep. And he was convicted without any physical evidence and by an all-white jury.
Surprise.
And he was...
I hate people.
Yeah. He was so small that he was made to sit on a Bible to fit into the chair properly. Oh. And his conviction wasn't overturned until 2014, by which time it was way too late, but you know.
Wow. At least what year was this?
Eventually it was overturned, 1944.
Okay.
Yep. So in modern times, the chair has been largely displaced by lethal injection, although it's still an option in some states. And controversy still exists over whether it may, in fact, be less painful and more humane than lethal injection.
Really?
Yes. So I came across a New York Times article that was from February of 2020.
Mm, okay.
And in Tennessee, there were several death row inmates who chose the electric chair as their method of execution.
Interesting.
Yeah, the state passed a law that it would use lethal injection, but
there was like a grandfathering in period where convicts
who had been convicted before.
Yeah, they could choose which method that they wanted. So a bunch of them were choosing the electric chair instead.
So was it just less like you don't feel yourself struggling to breathe like you might with?
That's what a lot of the inmates cited as their reason for choosing death by electric chair.
Interesting.
So in this article, they said that for the death by electric chair, you get two cycles of 1,750 volts of electricity.
Okay.
So high voltage.
Yes, for sure.
And this article was talking about Tennessee, and no other state had used the electric chair since 2013. So in Tennessee, the inmate advocates and lawyers said that the condemned men were worried that they would be frozen in place and feel intense discomfort while the drugs for lethal injection were working to kill them.
Okay.
And there have been lots of errors and problematic executions with lethal injection, including this one in Oklahoma in 2014, where an inmate regained consciousness during the process.
Oh, not a good look.
And so there's this widespread notice that it's not like actually a very humane way to go if it's not done properly, and also many pharmaceutical companies are making it more and more difficult for states to acquire the proper drugs because they don't want them associated with ending lives. Yeah,
can't really blame them.
Right. So yeah, I was surprised.
Wow.
I didn't know that the electric chair was still being used in places, and I also didn't know that Thomas Edison had a role in it becoming the method of choice back in the day.
So I spent a while trying to find a murder associated with electrocution.
Murder.
And I was able to find one that I'm going to tell you, but as we said, it's super rare.
As far as we know.
That's true, as far as we know. Because, I mean, most are accidents, there's a few suicides, but it's not common. So really, murder by electrocution is really, really uncommon. And to be fair, electricity has only been around for so long, so, you know, slightly less time, but still. And sure, it hasn't really been accessible to people for super long. But I found one. So, and this is almost exactly 50 years ago.
Oh.
So the 50th anniversary was back in July of 2020.
Happy birthday to me.
So on July 2nd, 1970, in Port Campbell, Victoria, Australia.
Mm.
So we're going to the other side of the world. A car was found at the bottom of a cliff at Lockard Gorge. Inside were the bodies of four dead people.
Ooh.
Teresa Crawford, who was 35 and 3 months pregnant.
No.
Catherine Jane, 13.
Oh.
James Williams, 8.
Ugh.
And Karen Jean, 6.
Okay.
So, around 1:30 on July 2nd, some tourists saw this car kind of on this ledge at the bottom of this gorge. And they called the police, and they sent somebody down, and they didn't realize for a while that there were people in there. And so they went in, and they saw these four dead people. And they traced the car's registration back to a house in Glenroy, Victoria, Australia, who was owned by Elmer Kyle Crawford, who was 40.
Another Elmer.
Another Elmer. Yep, the second Elmer that's come up today.
Note to self, do not name children Elmer.
Also, why would you name them Elmer?
Maybe I really liked Elmer Fudd.
You did it?
No, did not. Maybe I really like Elmer's glue.
Elmer's glue.
Wow, don't do drugs.
So Elmer, which I'm going to call him from now on because it's the most ridiculous name, was an Irish immigrant who immigrated, I think, like about 20 years earlier. So the police went to the house and, you know, knocked on the door and nobody answered. So in the first sweep of the house, they noticed that there were obvious bloodstains that somebody had tried to clean up. And there was also a letter, a half-finished letter, written by Teresa to a sister who was, like, bemoaning being pregnant and said that she was, you know, 2.5 to 3 months along at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, they wouldn't be able to visit them for the holidays because she was due at the end of January and that kind of thing.
Hmm.
So Teresa was not super happy about being prayers.
Well, you know there's a solution to that.
Well, we'll talk about that later.
Ah.
So autopsy showed that the mother, Teresa, had two electric burns to her ears.
Hmm.
The two oldest children also had those electric burns. And all three children were beaten with a hammer.
What?
In their head.
Hashtag overkill?
So much overkill.
Like with Topsy?
Yep, like with Topsy. Oh man, poor Topsy. So, as they continued to search the house, they found this crude electrocution device that consisted of about a 15 meters, about a 50 foot length of electrical lead that had alligator clips attached to two ends, and then it kind of went back and completed the circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And they surmised that Elmer attached these clips to his wife's ears while she slept and electrocuted her to death. He then took this device and electrocuted his two oldest children.
Yeah.
And then those two, along with the youngest, he then beat to death with a hammer.
Just to make sure that he finished the job.
So messed up. He then loaded their blanket-wrapped bodies, along with, they surmise, a motorbike, fuel cans, a rifle, and a hose, into the family car.
Uh-huh.
The backseat had already been removed to, you know, fit all the stuff. And he drove 200 kilometers, so like about 120 miles, to that gorge that I mentioned earlier. So this is like over 100 miles away from his house.
Yeah.
And then he connected that hose that he brought from the exhaust into the driver's side window. And then you know how like some of the roads have like a drainage ditch along the side?
Yeah.
So he covered that with like paving tiles and like things so he could push the car over this and over the edge. So hopefully it went down the gorge and into the ocean.
Oh.
So they surmise that essentially he electrocuted the wife and then beat the children to death.
Yeah.
And then he tried to make it look like a suicide from, like, you know, putting the hose through the thing.
Yeah.
And then pushed them over. So, and he was hoping that this would roll over and go into the ocean.
And not be found.
And one, not be found.
Yeah.
But two, if it is found and it's been in the water for a while and a lot of the soft tissue's gone away.
Yeah.
The kids all have these injuries that are going to be seen after decomposition.
Yeah.
But the wife isn't going to have any.
Right.
So he was trying to pose it like this was a murder-suicide.
Yeah.
So he then got back in that motorbike, they surmised, that he put in the car.
Oh.
And rode that motorbike home.
Okay.
But things that he wasn't expecting to happen are the car to get caught on that ledge.
Yeah.
That ended up getting caught on. So people found it the next day.
Yeah.
And so you know how I said that they were, like, it was obvious he was trying to clean? So they think he was trying to clean it so, like, the next day he can go and report his wife missing.
Right.
And then they can find the wife
yeah.
with it and, like, connect it all. But obviously they found it, and I don't, like, they didn't really surmise, like, how he exactly, you know, found this out and then went and ran away.
Yeah.
But the last time Elmer saw him, or anybody saw Elmer, was the day of the vehicle's discovery. He was seen in his driveway, but since then he has never been seen. Somebody said they reportedly saw him in 1994. This happened in 1970.
Wow.
An acquaintance said that they saw him in Western Australia, but you know,
yeah,
that was the only time. In 2008, I think they put out a $10,000 reward for him.
Wow.
And then in 2010, they actually found this man who died in Texas that they thought might be him.
Yeah.
But they connected, they like did a DNA test and they ruled him out. So why did he do this? Like what? Why are you doing this? So about 2 weeks before the murder, surprise, surprise, they redid their wills.
Yeah.
And he was going to come into a lot of money.
Mm.
So one of the biggest motivations they think is money. So on top of the fact that, you know, they redid the wills, this guy had been stealing from his employer and selling stuff.
Oh.
And his wife apparently might have been threatening to go to the cops about this, which that would be motivation.
Yeah.
There's also surmising, you know, maybe she was thinking about divorcing him and he would lose all the money and that. And then the other thing is the baby, right? So they already have three kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's thought that maybe Elmer was trying to convince Teresa to get an abortion.
Yeah.
But Teresa was Catholic. So she, they think, might have pushed back against that. Again, these
even
are all...
Even though she didn't want the baby either.
Well, she was bemoaning it. So this letter pretty much just was like, you know, I'm struggling, but I'm pregnant. And she never really said anything that was like, I want to get an abortion. Like, that was never...
Yeah.
It didn't sound like that was really hinted at. She was just struggling and probably complaining to a friend in a letter about it, right?
Right.
Processing. But they think that he might have wanted to stop the pregnancy, and she pushed back on it.
Yeah.
So those are the possible theories, but nobody has seen him, so nobody can ask him.
Right.
So,
or we have seen him, but nobody knows it's him.
Dun, dun, dun.
So you just told me an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. How cool.
So speaking of the media, this has 3 times been put into various true crime stuff, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Oh.
In May of 2006, this was an episode of Sensing Murder. There's apparently a show called Sensing Murder that did this.
Hmm.
There's a book by Greg Fogarty called Almost Perfect, The True Story of the Crawford Family Murders. And this is a guy that actually grew up on that same street.
Whoa.
And then in 2016, there's a podcast episode of Felon True Crime Podcast that featured this murder.
Interesting.
And now there's this podcast that features this murder.
Oh my gosh. So, are we going to be added to the Murderpedia page?
Oh, I really hope so. This wasn't Murderpedia. This was Wikipedia.
Oh, we can just add ourselves to Wikipedia.
Yeah. So there was an article from July 2020, so 50 years, that they're still looking for this murderer, and a $100,000 reward still stands.
Wow. Okay. So things I'm going to do when I'm in Australia: keep an eye out for this dude.
And he, like, they have some age progress photos, and he looks exactly like his picture from Murderpedia, just with, like, a longer nose and grayer hair.
Yeah, because that's how people age.
It was really good. Yeah.
Huh. Huh. People.
So you know what's not shocking that everybody likes?
Sesmeads!
Sesmeads!
So if you liked this and any of our other episodes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. It's how we get boosted up on the various podcasting platforms and other people learn about us.
You can visit our website at deadmendotellpodcast.com, where we link to all of our sources in our episode guide. Shout out Murderpedia and Wikipedia.
On Twitter, we're at deadmendo.
On Insta, we're at the Dead Tell Tales.
Our Facebook page is Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And as always, please send us an email, comments, questions, concerns, just saying hi, through this website or directly to thedeadtelltales@gmail.com.
And our opening music is Introducing the Pre-Roll by Lee Rosevere, who you can find on SoundCloud.
Thanks so much for listening, guys.
Yeah, thank you. And be careful. Don't stick your fingers in any outlets.
Bzz.
Or your toes.
Bzz.
Or your tongue.
Bzz.
Just don't.
Bzz.
Bzz.